This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, you can't. That's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
What are your thoughts on snail mail? An old-timey letter, handwritten, the whole thing. It used to be the only way to communicate, obviously, but now it seems some young people who maybe have never experienced letter writing, receiving letters, writing them, are trying to bring it back. G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack, and coming up we're talking letter writing and what's prompted this recent surge in interest.
It feels really personal and it's like a piece that kind of connects you with someone else.
Yeah, fascinating. If you were a person who loves to put pen to paper, I want to hear from you. Like, who do you write to? Why do you prefer this method of communication? Message in 0439 757 555. Also, coming up on Hack, we're going to be talking about abortion access in Australia because you might have seen a lot of stuff in the headlines recently. It's been making news for various reasons, so we'll discuss why. First, though,
Hack. President Trump says a deal between the United States and Iran is, quote, now complete.
On Triple J.
Both sides are claiming it as a win. The United States saying it's a massive success. Iran calling it a great victory. So what is this ceasefire agreement that's been struck between the two sides? Does it actually mean peace is around the corner after months of war? Because we've been hearing about breakthroughs for so many weeks. Is this any different? Shannon Schubert's been looking into it.
Some breaking news out of the United States. President Donald Trump has confirmed a peace deal with Iran has been reached.
Pakistan says the US and Iran have finally reached a deal to end their war.
Donald Trump has posted on social media, "Ships of the world, start your engines. Let the oil flow."
This morning, US President Donald Trump posted to Truth Social that a deal with Iran was complete and the Strait of Hormuz would soon reopen. In response, oil prices dropped by more than 4% within minutes of the market's opening. But we've heard Trump claim a deal was close almost 40 times. So how did we finally get here and what makes this time different? Let's back up a bit. Over the weekend, the terms of the deal were being negotiated, but then it was nearly derailed.
On Sunday afternoon, Israel launched a strike on a claimed Hezbollah command centre in southern Beirut after the Iranian-backed militant group fired rockets and drones towards communities in northern Israel.
Those strikes killed three people and injured 16 in Lebanon and prompted threats of retaliation from Iran.
Iran says its finger is on the trigger to attack.
It also angered the US president, who said while Israel has the right to defend itself, the original attack from Hezbollah was small and meaningless. And Israel's strike on Beirut should not have happened.
Donald Trump has had another expletive-laden confrontation with Benjamin Netanyahu after Israel launched a strike on the Lebanese capital.
Lebanon has been a point of contention in these negotiations. US and Israel have treated it as somewhat separate to the broader regional conflict. But Iran is demanding Lebanon be included in any ceasefire. And under the current deal, it is. Here's Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister, Kazem Gharibabadi, speaking on the memorandum.
We have no trust whatsoever in the enemy. Our trust is in our military power, our diplomatic strength, and the support of unity of our own people. For that reason, implementation of this memorandum is extremely important.
Despite the recent strikes, Pakistan, the US and Iran all confirmed the deal this morning. But the prospect of a deal hasn't always been welcomed by all. Hardline supporters of the Iranian regime have previously showed their disapproval to a potential deal with wide-scale protests in Tehran. So what does this deal actually mean? Well, the current agreement is being described as a framework towards peace. It includes a 60-day ceasefire, with all parties committing to signing a memorandum in Switzerland on Friday.
During the 60-day negotiations, we have several issues to address. The first is the termination of all sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran, including unilateral sanctions.
The news of a major step forward in a supposed peace deal has been met with hesitance by many, as ceasefires have been broken before and a lot can happen in 4 days. If the memorandum is signed at the end of this week, President Trump says the Strait of Hormuz will reopen, relieving pressure on fuel supply across the world. Then there will be negotiations on a commitment from Iran to not pursue nuclear weapons, along with negotiations around unfreezing Iranian assets and lifting economic sanctions. Here's US Vice President J.D. Vance.
To certainly eliminate the nuclear threat of Iran, that's done. But now possibly to build to a new era of Middle East prosperity and success.
Back home, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese welcomes the prospect of a peace deal.
We want this agreement to stick because it is in the interests of people in that region to end the military conflict, but it's also in the interests of the entire world.
Hack on Triple J.
Shannon Schubert reporting there, and Israel's National Security Minister Ben-Gvir has made a statement in the last few hours denouncing the deal between the United States and Iran, insisting Israel is not bound by it and saying we must not withdraw from a single inch of territory that our soldiers have captured. So that is what we're hearing from one Israeli minister at least. Lots of questions many of you have about this on the text line. Someone says, let's not forget that Trump started this war, that he's so desperate to end. Let's ask an expert some questions. And Dr. Ben Rich from Curtin University is with us now. Ben, thank you very much for your time.
Good afternoon.
So is this a massive breakthrough, this framework for a peace deal, or are we just back to where we were a few months ago?
Look, I mean, I think if we talk about it in the context of the last 100 days, it's definitely significant. But if we compare it to where we, you know, were before the war started, we're not back to there. We are miles back. This is a, you know, unabashed strategic defeat for the United States. It's really shown that the US can't exert itself in the world in the way that perhaps it could, you know, 20 years ago when it took out Iraq in 2003. And it's shown that Iran, you know, is not just a paper tiger in the region, that it is actually able to dramatically affect not only its region but the global economy in a way that the US really just doesn't have an answer for at this point.
As you say, there are a lot of contentious issues at play and stuff that's going to be negotiated over the next few weeks. Do you think it is highly likely all of this could fall apart because there still are so many differences in opinions on how the way forward should look?
Well, I think for both Iran and the United States, there is definitely a will and a desire to move forward for different reasons. The reality is, though, as has been throughout this fight, the spoiler is going to be Israel. And Israel just does not want to come out of this war looking like it's lost. And at this stage, where things have sort of solidified, it looks like it's lost. The Iranian regime is still in power. And indeed, you have a more hardline regime there now because you've killed so many of the people who were previously on the top, and you've sort of let, you know, officers in the IRGC who are sort of younger and more hardline assume positions of power in the government. And you've shown, you know, you've shown the Iranians can actually fight US and Israel off, you know, and this was something that was debated up to the war. But I think there was a sense in Israel in particular, like that combined with the United States, it was a real chance to topple the Iranian regime. And instead, the regime has survived. It's certainly been harmed. You know, I think the economic consequences of this are going to just starting to be felt now there and will be felt for years to come. But, you know, you have a major rival in the region that has weathered the storm. And if we look back at, say, historical examples of this, I'm just put in mind of the Suez Crisis in 1956, where Western powers, along with Israel, attacked a Middle Eastern state, Egypt. The idea of basically acquiring a strategic piece of land. Egypt held on, and it emerged from that fight far stronger, despite the fact it hadn't militarily defeated its opposition, but far stronger in the region, and Israel was dealing with the consequences of that for decades afterwards.
How do you think the people of Iran are going to respond to this? Because there was a lot of hope by a lot of people in Iran and a lot of the diaspora around the world, including here in Australia, that this would lead to some sort of regime change. There was a lot of hope there. Now that that looks very unlikely, how do you think it's going to be received by Iranians?
I think it depends on what Iranians millions we're talking about. It's a big, it's a country with, you know, tens of millions of people in it, and there's a wide array of views on things. I think the reality is that you're going to have a rallying around the flag effect, at least in the short term. Nothing really brings people together than a foreign war being under attack. And it's the unfortunate reality of the world we're sort of living in. And I think it will absolutely harm, at least in the short term, efforts for proper democratization in the country, because you not only has the regime been able to consolidate its power, but it's actually shown it's able to defend the country.
And just finally, Ben, what does this mean for other Australians when they're filling up at the fuel pump and that kind of thing? Like, do you think we genuinely will see a bit more stability when it comes to fuel prices because of a settling down of tensions in the Middle East?
Well, I think part of the problem is that we really haven't felt the fuel shocks yet. I mean, the government's obviously done the fuel, removed the fuel excise temporarily. We were still receiving oil tankers that had been sent out prior to the war up until very recently. And it's now that kind of lag that we're going to see, that we're going to feel that gap left by all those tankers that have been stuck in the Gulf or unable to get into Gulf to move it. So those shocks are really going to be felt in the coming months. Hopefully this will, you know, stay stable. Hopefully we won't have spoilers. But I think even in the most optimal scenario, we are going to see prices increasing, inflation, all these things as a flow-on effect. It's not that these things are felt immediately, but, you know, once that fuel is removed from the system for a prolonged period of time, it takes a while for things to spool back up. In the same way, it takes time to start oil extraction processes. These things don't just, you don't just turn them off and on with the flick of a button. They can take weeks to get back online. So I think we're going to have to brace for that.
Dr. Ben Rich from Curtin University, really appreciate your take. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hack.
Ultimately, taking away abortion rights has never been shown to reduce the number of abortions.
On Triple J.
Abortion access has been all over the news recently in this country, and that's because in a few different states, debates are underway over when or how abortions can be accessed. In Queensland, in South Australia, in New South Wales. Now, health advocates are saying it's led to a lot of misinformation circulating. So what do we know, and where are we up to with all of this? Scout Wallen has this update.
You made the effort to stand up for those who can't stand up for themselves.
That's One Nation MP Barnaby Joyce. He was standing on the steps of New South Wales Parliament earlier this month, voicing his support for a bill to ban abortions for the purpose of sex selection.
Politically, does this make you popular? No.
This bill that Barnaby is supporting is one of three attempts to restrict abortion access over the past few weeks in three separate state parliaments. The president of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists, Dr. Nisha Cott, says misinformation is fueling the debate.
Abortion care, which is legally available in Australia, is under threat. And the people who are behind this have already made it very clear that their ultimate aim is to make abortion illegal in this country.
So what's going on? Well, let's start in New South Wales, where Libertarian MP John Ruddick wants to ban abortions for the sake of sex selection, though the practice is already prohibited under the state's health policy. Here's Mr. Ruddick speaking in Parliament when he tabled the bill last year.
In Australia, we are absolutely committed to the principle that a baby boy has an entirely equal value to a baby girl.
A review into sex-selective abortions by New South Wales Health found the practice was not widespread. Of the more than 15,000 abortions between 2019 and 2020, 13 were reported to have been for sex selection, but the review found that 10 were likely reporting errors. Debate on the bill started about a fortnight ago, but a vote is not expected anytime in the near future. Now to South Australia, where the law currently permits abortions after 23 weeks with the approval of two doctors if the pregnancy would put the mum's physical or mental health at significant risk. Upper House member Sarah Game is introducing legislation to effectively ban abortion from 25 weeks onwards, except when it's necessary to save the mother's life. She says the parliament has a responsibility to protect vulnerable human life.
The only reason that the bill permits is that to save the mother's life if that was deemed necessary, but quite frankly, from what I've looked at, that would never be necessary.
Just 1% of terminations in 2024 were completed after 23 weeks, according to the South Australian Abortion Reporting Committee's annual report. Back to Dr. Cott.
If we don't have the ability to support women and families to make these decisions, there is the trauma of having to give birth to a child that you know is not going to survive.
The bill may pass the state's upper house now that there's some new One Nation members, but it'll have a more difficult time passing the lower house, where Labor holds a majority. And what about in Queensland? Well, in early June, Robbie Katter from the Katter Australia Party tried to circumnavigate a gag on discussing abortion in Parliament to try to scrap a clause from Queensland's Medicine Act. That clause relates to the accessibility of abortion drugs, known in Australia as MS Two-Step, which in Queensland can currently be prescribed by approved healthcare providers up until the 9-week mark. Mr. Katter claimed that a change in the wording of the clause impacted specific training requirements for staff.
We, in that pro-life camp, say that you are affecting lives here, which makes this a really important thing.
Queensland's Health Minister Tim Nicholls replied that the training requirements were just a change in style, not in form or substance.
It is a misinformed and misconceived motion.
The motion was defeated 85 votes to 2, with the 2 votes in favour coming from the Katter Party. Although these 3 motions or bills all have different aims, Dr. Cott says they're part of a broader pattern.
I would hate to see what is happening in America happen in Australia. We have to remember that although these voices are loud, they are the minority. And it's important that we remember that the majority of Australians are compassionate, empathetic people who support women's right to abortion.
Hack on Triple J.
Scott Wallen reporting there. Look, let's get into some detail a bit more now with Prudence Flowers, who's a senior lecturer at Flinders Uni and someone who has researched abortion and family planning. Prudence, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
Do we know what Australians' view of abortion broadly is, whether the majority do support access to abortion services?
Yes, we've got decades of polling that indicate that Australia is a really pro-choice nation. So the most recent poll, which was done this year by the Australia Institute, found that about 62% of people supported access to abortion services. Another 25% support abortion access in limited circumstances. It also found a majority of One Nation supporters, for example, a majority of Liberal supporters. It's kind of a across the party line that people are pro-choice. And it's a really small minority that actually oppose access to abortion. For decades, that's hovered at between 5 to 8%.
Yeah, I saw that figure of 8% and, yeah, thought that that seemed like a relatively low number, especially if we're talking about One Nation, which is a party that started to talk more about abortion. Why do you think that would be if such a small amount of Australians oppose it?
I think that the kind of current experimentation going on within One Nation around abortion is kind of reflective of broader currents. So, you know, for most of the 21st century, when abortion legislation has come up, it has been to decriminalise or to improve access. So the story of Australia in the 21st century is a story of kind of liberalising abortion access and removing it from the criminal code and regulating it like healthcare. It's really only been in the last few years that we've started to see this kind of surge in anti-abortion bills. You know, this really begins in about 2024 when you start to see them in South Australia and you start to see it coming up in the Queensland election. And then there were bills last year. And now we've got kind of 3 issues all happening in June. And so I think what we're seeing is One Nation potentially hoping to capitalize on what it sees as a kind of a new way of bringing American-style culture wars into Australia. Because, you know, since Pauline Hanson's been back in the Senate since 2016, she's been very explicitly aligning herself with kind of Trump and MAGA-ish politics. And Hanson has, for example, been really at the forefront of pursuing anti-trans legislation during her time in the Senate. So this is kind of part and parcel of that broader American-style culture wars politics. And I think in some ways this is a moment of experimentation, but it's also because she clearly sees some kind of important shift having happened within the way that anti-abortion activists operate in Australia.
Okay, but important to point out that it is somewhat different to the strategy maybe that Pauline Hanson has used in previous years or her previous stance.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it's really, to me, curious to see Pauline Hanson being championed in some quarters as an anti-abortion advocate. She was quite explicitly pro-choice in her language in the 1990s, and she still is very clear That she has no problem with abortion in the first trimester, which is actually when over 90% of abortions in Australia occur. So she's not actually anti-abortion, nor is she opposed to euthanasia, which is another big issue for these people who oppose abortion. So there's this kind of curious pragmatism, cynicism, I might say, in what's going on in her kind of pivot towards this embrace of a cohort of people who actually don't share her values.
Okay, this is interesting. It's Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Prudence Flowers, who is an academic who is researching at Flinders University. We're speaking about abortion access across Australia and why we're starting to see a bit of this discussion and debate in the headlines, because we know in several states in Australia there are debates around abortion. I'm hearing from you on the text line, someone saying, I had access to an abortion in Queensland, and without it, I would have been stuck in an abusive relationship. I do think that after a certain number of weeks, we shouldn't be allowed to access them, though. Another person, Nick from the Sunny Coast, saying Barnaby Joyce is cooked. Okay, that is Nick's opinion there on the text line. Prudence, has the Coalition like had a clear line on this issue in recent years?
So I think one of the things that's interesting is that all of the major parties, all of the major parties and many of the minor parties allow politicians to exercise a conscience vote. So One Nation does as well. And that's one of the things that can be kind of confusing, because One Nation has these very high profile, very anti-abortion new recruits. So people like Barnaby Joyce in New South Wales, Corey Bernardi in South Australia, Bernie Finn in Victoria, they are very, very anti-abortion and have been for a long time, but their party allows a conscience vote. And so that One Nation is in some ways just like the Nationals, just like the Liberals, just like Labor, in that they allow conscience votes. Within the Liberal and National parties, what has been happening in the last few years has been, I guess you could say, that kind of jockeying between more hard right figures who want the party to kind of embrace Trumpish politics and other people within the parties who kind of still adhere to that vision of the kind of moderate Liberal Party that once existed. And so there's not one position that you could identify with the Liberals or the Nationals, but it is important to note that, for example, the current leader of the National Party, Matt Canavan, is very, very anti-abortion and has been historically for a long time.
And Prudence, South Australia has a vote coming up this week. What's happening there?
So the vote that we're having on Wednesday will be the third anti-abortion bill that our parliament has considered in about 18 months. And this bill focuses on later gestation abortion. It is widely expected to pass the upper house, largely because of the election of the three One Nation members of the Legislative Council in our recent SA election. So that has incrementally changed the balance of power in the upper house. And it seems highly unlikely that it would be voted down in the upper house. And this is pretty significant, because that would really be the first time since decriminalisation has happened in Australia that an anti-abortion bill has had any success at any level. And so given that a lot of what the anti-abortion strategies are, which is to kind of mimic what happened in the US, you know, to pursue lawfare against abortion rights, to pursue what they call an incrementalist approach, they will take SA, you know, they will take a victory in the SA upper house as kind of further encouragement to continue with this strategy, even though it has almost no prospects in the lower house.
Yeah, a lot of people will be keeping across that, wanting to know how that plays out. Prudence Flowers, Senior Lecturer at Flinders University, really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got a lot of messages coming through on the text line. Someone saying, I never understood the logic of being against it. If you don't want it, just don't do it. That person saying, someone else saying, why do people care what others do with their bodies? And someone else saying, it makes me angry that men like that think they can have a say on women's rights. All right, we're going to move on.
Hack. You know what we absolutely need to bring back? Letters.
On Triple J.
And maybe we have. Maybe letters are back. When was the last time you wrote a card or a letter or received some snail mail that wasn't junk mail, like actual handwritten stuff? Because snail mail clubs are taking off, young Australians posting thousands of letters, and ironically, they've been trending on socials as well. Some are subscribing to get themed paper packs for journaling, others want to bring back the art of letter writing. If this is you, tell me about it. Why do you love writing letters so much? Who do you write to? 0439 757 555. Well, it may or may not surprise you that I am into letter writing. And when reporter Grace McKinnon decided to look into it, I decided to post her a letter to get things started.
Why is Dave Marchese writing to me?
Lovely Grace. Honestly, I'm so happy to hear you love snail mail as well.
I've always loved sending and receiving letters. It's something I've done in romantic relationships and with close friends. You don't get letters often, and writing to your mate is pretty uncommon these days. But here's the thing, Gen Z is trying to bring it back. So getting this letter from Dave is a good start.
I feel like it's a lost art, writing letters and just putting pen to paper.
I just received my first happy mail.
Open up this witchy snail mail with me.
Writing letters, snail mail clubs, collage and junk journals, a lot of these hobbies you might stereotype as something you do in retirement, but they're getting popular with a new generation who ironically found out about them online. Aussie artist Alessia started Cloudy Club, a snail mail club. At its peak, she had thousands of subscribers located across the world.
I think the biggest thing that sort of draws people in is that it feels really personal and it's like a piece that kind of connects you with someone else.
Each month, hundreds of her subscribers receive a wax-sealed envelope in the mail. Inside, they find a letter, a sticker and postcard covered in artwork she's designed with a new theme each month, and some journal prompts to encourage your own writing.
I think people really crave connection, especially offline. People get really sick of, obviously, like social media, doom scrolling.
Even though young people are sending thousands of letters to each other, there's still a steady drop-off in the amount of letters we send as a whole. AusPost says less than 3% of letters in Australia are sent by everyday people. Most are sent by businesses and government agencies.
There's a generation that has skipped letter writing in general, and I think to them it's so foreign and novel that I think it's like really exciting.
AusPost wants to bump up the price of stamps by 15 cents to make up for the financial loss of people sending less letters. Alessia reckons when that happens, her business takes a hit.
I literally spend like almost $3,000 a month on stamps some months. So yeah, even like a 20 cent increase per letter, like it definitely gets felt, yeah.
AusPost said there was almost a 12% drop-off in letters for the 2025 financial year, excluding election activities. That kind of drop-off hasn't been seen in Australia since the late 1930s.
So many of us like didn't grow up receiving letters. Like it's a really foreign concept to so many young people.
Instead of no junk mail, I'd love to have more love letters. Imagine that.
Jeanette Coffey's been writing letters since she was a kid. And when she moved from Ireland to Australia, she started writing to her dad.
It was a beautiful way of connecting because we had quite a distant relationship. For a lot of his life, he had lived with mental health challenges and with addiction at times. I don't think we would have got to that place without our letters.
Jeanette hosted a letter writing session in Melbourne recently and called it the Lost Letters Club, where people gather to write letters to someone they love or for themselves.
I think it's about exercising that muscle because sitting down to write a letter, it isn't easy. There is a lot of vulnerability in it.
Zoe and Maximilian run That Paper Joint, a collage studio, workshop and shop in Brunswick. Their MO is connecting people through paper.
We do spend a lot of time online and on our phones, but there's something about the immediacy of using your hands with paper that really just brings you down into that very exact moment.
Stepping through the shop, you can't help but feel like a kid. It's filled with paper craft materials. Vintage stamps, printed paper, themed stickers, notepads, collage books, scissors, pens, markers. If it's related to paper, they've got it. They've been open for 5 years, but saw a huge boom in business last year thanks to the junk journaling trend and young people finding offline hobbies.
To receive something where like someone has taken the time to write your name in their handwriting and you get it and you're like, it's really, really sweet.
Hack on Triple J.
Grace McKinnon reporting there. Oh, so lovely. And of course, Grace is into letter writing. I'm into letter writing. No one's surprised by that. It's a very Dave-coded thing to be into. Also hearing from so many of you on the text line now, someone saying, I've written letters for many years, primarily to family. It's so nice to receive a personal letter. It represents a high level of respect and consideration. We've got Antonia on the line from Melbourne. Antonia, you're also into letter writing.
Yeah, Dave.
What got you into it? Why do you love it so much?
At uni, some lecturers freaked me out because they said a line about if your handwriting's illegible, that they won't grade your exam. So that got the ball rolling on getting into fountain pens, getting into ink, really being interested in paper. And obviously getting a letter in the mail is actually a really nice tie-in of all those elements.
It absolutely is. And I saw that you said that you got a lovely letter with a capybara sticker on it, which sounds absolutely beautiful. Antonia, thank you so much for chatting with us. We've also got other people on the text line. Someone says, I write with a friend in London. We've been writing since he left Australia almost 8 years ago. I love finding his letters in my mailbox. Another person, my ex-girlfriend and I dabbled in long distance, and one night she told me she's an old school romantic, so I wrote her a beautiful letter, but her bestie was there when she opened it and laughed her ass off. Oh, okay, didn't end well there. All right, that is all we've got time for on Hack for now. Hack.